Cassar Jane Show, Talk Radio for Fine Minds, airs Wednesdays, 3 p.m. Eastern, and is always available for your listening pleasure at HallieCassarJane.com. Thank you so much for joining me. I am Hallie Cassar Jane. Today on the Hallie Cassar Jane Show, a no-holds-barred conversation with an Emmy and Golden Globe-nominated actor, long the subject of tabloid fodder. Joining me at my table to talk about his roller coaster life, his story told in his new autobiography, Renegaded Heart, his Hollywood heartthrob, Lorenzo Lamas. But before we begin, a brief message from our sponsors. You are listening to The Hallie Cassar Jane Show. The Hallie Cassar Jane Show is always available online at HallieCassarJane.com and a host of venues, including Blog Talk Radio. Be sure to visit us at our newest home on iHeartRadio. Today, the Hallie Cassar Jane Show is brought to you by Audible.com, a leading provider of spoken audio information and entertainment. Listen to audiobooks whenever and wherever you want. If you want to listen to it, Audible has it. With over 150,000 titles in virtually every genre, you'll find what you're looking for. Get a free audiobook and 30-day trial today by signing up at www.audibletrial.com/ The Hallie Cassar Jane Show.
Is someone you love living with frequent pain? Are they spending more time just sitting in a chair or lying in bed or going to the ER more often? Other than taking them to the doctor, you may not know what else to do. Treasure Coast Hospice can help in more ways than you may realize. Even if you don't think your loved one is ready for hospice care, their experts can evaluate your loved one's condition and direct you to the right resources in our community. Call Treasure Coast Hospice to learn more or visit tchospice.org.
Hello. I'm Hallie Cassar Jane, host of the Hallie Cassar Jane Show. Join me Wednesdays at 3 p.m. Eastern when I talk with the great artists, writers, musicians, politicians, and celebrities of our day. The Hallie Cassar Jane Show is talk radio for fine minds. Tune in live or listen to the podcast at HallieCassarJane.com. Son of film stars Fernando Lamas and Arlene Dahl, and stepson of swimmer and actress Esther Williams, Lorenzo Lamas was born into Hollywood royalty. He entered the family business in his teens and has played many roles over the course of his roller coaster career. Emmy and Golden Globe nominated star of two major television shows, Falcon Crest and Renegade, five-time husband, and reality show star, Lorenzo has been tabloid fodder for decades. Fans believe they know every side of him, but the truth is far more interesting and surprising. Featuring more than 50 rare, never-before-shared family and personal photographs from Lorenzo's private collection, his new book, Renegaded Heart, is everything fans have been waiting for. The unvarnished truth of his remarkable journey and fully-fleshed rumination of the highs, lows, and survival of an extraordinary man and actor. From a life-threatening motorcycle accident and clashing with his father over a photo shoot for Playgirl magazine, to the wisdom gained from fatherhood and multiple marriages, Lorenzo's life story is as engaging and unpredictable as the plot line from one of the soap operas in which he starred. Let's talk.
I got to tell you something. Talk about, you are an open book. What's the deal with you? I mean, you have such courage to get out there and just bear it all. Why? How come?
I think I reached an age at 57 that if I didn't write a book, I probably never would. It's an age I feel I have now some perspective on some of the decisions that I've made and some of the mistakes and the way my life kind of rolled out, the great experiences and the challenging ones.
So I got to say this to you. I know from the outside, looking in, people think Lorenzo Lamas, gorgeous, stunning Lorenzo Lamas, by the way, son of the dashing film star Fernando and the glamorous Arlene Dahl, his stepmother, the accomplished swimmer and film star Esther Williams. Boy, wasn't he just a lucky kid. Did you feel lucky?
Not particularly. Looking back at my young life, I feel lucky that I had, 4 or 5 years of a real idyllic sort of Mayberry RFD childhood. But, again, it was from a certain age to a certain age. I would say from like maybe 9 years old to about 12. I had a wonderful, normal childhood with neighborhood friends. We'd stay out in the summer until 9:30 at night in the street playing ball and riding our bikes and hiking around the Santa Monica Mountains. It was very idyllic. But that was a pretty small window there when you look back at your whole childhood from the earliest memory up to, let's say, high school graduation. It was filled with moves and stepfathers and missing my own father, and traveling, starting new schools almost every other year. And that's tough on a kid, you know?
Your parents were in the business. They were in the film business. And I think a lot of people on the outside don't realize just how much of a business the film business is, and that it's a 24/7 business. It's not a 9-to-5 job. So one of the things that I loved about the honesty in your book is the way that you talk about the fact that they weren't there for you. I read it, my heart went out. A neglected child in a way, weren't you?
Well, I had love. I mean, my parents really loved me to the best of their capabilities, given their schedules and their capacity to love. I never felt ignored, particularly, although I did spend a lot of time alone in my room or just at other kids' parents' houses. But, you know, having just said that, I also feel that my mother loved me as much as she was capable of loving me. And my father did too, given his temperament and his background. You know, very strong, Latin, judgmental father. He was strict in many ways, but loving in others. I never felt ignored or not loved.
That's the adult.
I always wanted more time with
your dad.
With my dad.
Yeah.
And that was the most difficult thing, I think, to deal with as a kid, is not having two parents that you could depend on to be supportive of whatever you're going through as a kid, you know, whether it's just the first day at school or whether, you know, you get picked on and your grades aren't good and you feel stupid in class and things that kids go home and talk to their folks about and hopefully get support. I just had to deal with on my own.
Right. Talk to me about your dad. I was thinking when I was reading the book that it would have been easier if he'd had a daughter. You should have been a girl. That he was handsome. He was sexy. He was the poster boy of the time for, you know, everything what a man should be. Fernando Lamas. Oh, yeah, 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 yeah. I mean, he was just stunning. And when you were a kid, you know, that's a hard act to follow. Did you feel that way?
Well, he had a daughter. He had two daughters.
Right, but you were the son.
My oldest sister, I didn't even know existed in the world until he was on his deathbed.
Really?
I didn't know that. My sister, Christy, had no idea I had a sister, an older sister. So, I mean, you mentioned that if I was a daughter, I might have had a little bit easier time. I think I had the best of it, you know, considering. And my second oldest sister, Alex, barely saw my dad. My dad came to America in 1951 under contract to MGM, and he basically left my sister and her mom in Argentina and pursued an acting career for years before he brought them up to live with, and then that didn't last very long. So when you mention the fact that people in show business, people don't understand how involving it is, it's very true. I mean, I don't see how it's possible to have a normal family with kids and a career in show business.
I agree with you. And I think that plays out in your own personal life, too, which is interesting. We're going to get into that later about I'm amused by the fact that you wound up being an actor after everything that you went through as a kid and saw. But the way in which you describe your relationship with your dad, it's gorgeous. You did a damn good job, I have to tell you, in the book about that. I felt like I was there when I was reading it. The good and the bad, the pull and the push, which I think all fathers and sons, by the way, probably have to some degree. But he had very high expectations of himself, and he had them of you too, didn't he?
Well, I think that my dad just really wanted to be accepted as an actor and a director without any stereotype attached to him, given his Argentine heritage. His struggle, my father's struggle, was a different one than I had and have. My father's struggle was to be recognized as an equal in a business that didn't recognize Latino actors or treat them as the same as non-ethnic actors. And, you know, given the nature of the roles that he was offered, he was stereotyped. And that's one of the reasons why he got into directing, because he felt that as a director, he was able to contribute more on an equal playing field, of equal level of acceptance towards his cast and his crew. He was the director. he had a vision, and his job was to impart his vision on everybody on the set. That was very fulfilling for him.
Yeah.
So he was completely obsessed with himself and his career and making a name for himself in show business. I was sort of an accessory in many ways. He was concerned about my welfare, but then I lived in New York for many years, and he was here in California. It was difficult for him to really play a very integral role in my life growing up as a father. But we did try as much as we could to make the most of the time we had together.
Two things you say. One was, this is what you wrote, "I shared my parents with the world. They do not really belong to me." And I read that, I went, ouch, whoa.
Yeah,
buddy.
And I realized that at a pretty young age. You know, I mean, listen, I think kids that have challenges in their youth end up being more prepared for life's challenges. You know, I mean, so there's a good part of being, you know, a kid in a broken home and having to move constantly and having to get used to new people in your life on a regular basis. I think it really helped. It helped me grow quick and certainly made me ready for being an actor and having to work with different people all the time and travel and all that stuff. So, I mean, there's good things about it. It wasn't all just like challenging hard, you know.
No, of course not.
There were some good points. We
right.
traveled all over the world.
Yeah, well, we'll get to that in a second. But back to your dad just for the moment. Fernando Llamas, Latin lover, it's the 1950s. There's a poignant story that you tell about him having the last name Llamas and what your father told you about it. It says about a lot about who your dad was. Tell us that, because, you know, I didn't, you know, we live in these times. I mean, what's the difference to me whether your name is Llamas or whatever, you know?
Yeah,
or
when I was a kid, yeah. I had a very strange name.
Right.
My classmates thought I was just from a different planet, you know, because of my name Lorenzo. And a Lorenzo, wow, who are you and why do you have such a weird name and all that. So in third grade and fourth grade, it, you know, bugged me a lot and I got teased by it. And one day I was particularly upset about being called weird on the playground. And my dad picked me up and drove me to a street in Pacific Palisades, which is where I grew up and went to school. And he looked up at a street sign. He pointed at that street sign. He said, "Lorenzo, what does that street sign say?" I said, "Lorenzo Drive." He said, "Exactly." He said, "Your name is important. Lorenzo Drive. You know, this state, this Southwest, all of our neighboring states were discovered and basically grown by Latin people, by the Mexicans and the Spanish before them. And there were villages and what's the word for the churches?
Iglesias in Spanish.
All up and down
sure.
the coast are Catholic missionaries and churches built. San Luis Obispo, you know, Los Angeles, San Diego, La Jolla, all these wonderful Latin developed communities. And my father said, "That's a very important part of American history, and don't forget it." So the next time somebody makes fun of your name, ask them if they have a street named after them.
Exactly. I love that.
And
yeah.
It kind of, it made me feel better about having a weird name.
Not so weird. It did you well. Let's talk about your mom just for a minute. Arlene Dahl, gorgeous, smart, alluring, fascinating. By the way, got to tell you, you got the best of the both of them. Lucky you. I mean, seriously, you know, that's a good thing. You didn't think so when you were a kid because you thought you were kind of pudgy. And we'll talk about that in a minute.
No, I still look in the mirror and see a fat kid. So I
do you really? Come on.
I absolutely have no I have no relationship with the status of hunk. I always was uncomfortable with it because I never felt like I was, you know, and I think that's good. I think that was probably a very healthy thing for me.
I don't know. I
you
think
know, having to struggle with weight and eyesight and stuff. So, I mean, it was, I think, very humbling to not have all the goods until perhaps later, you know, in life, in my 20s. When I started acting, I was very fortunate that I was tall and I had decent teeth and, you know.
And bone and all those wonderful things.
That was a calling card. That was a calling card back in the day, you know, for an actor.
So when you look in the mirror, you don't see good looking even now?
I don't really. No, I see all the things that are wrong. I'm just a normal person.
Has there ever been a moment that you looked?
I have insecurities and
sure.
You know,
oh, sure. But what is there ever been a moment when you looked in the mirror and you went, not so bad?
Well, my wife is so sweet. She always compliments me, you know, and I think that's really, important. I try to do the same thing with her.
But that's not you.
She's my biggest cheerleader.
Right, and, but that's not you. You're not looking in the mirror and seeing cute. No, not happening.
Who, me?
Yeah, you.
No.
That's too bad.
You are listening to the Hallie Kasser Jane Show, always available online at HallieKasserJane.com. My guest today, author of Renegade at Heart, actor Lorenzo Lamas.
And so even though your parents divorced and your dad married Esther Williams, who we ought to talk about, I guess, for a minute, it appears from all accounts that they had a pretty good marriage, your father and Esther. And she became a surrogate mother to you in a degree, right? To a degree.
Yeah, she did. She, in many ways, was the maternal woman in my life for quite a few years, you know, from probably after high school, for the first year after high school, before I got my apartment. Esther was really there for me. She taught me how to balance a checkbook, how to do laundry. I didn't know how to do anything. I went to military. So I threw my laundry in a bag and I put it out in front of my dorm, and that it disappeared. And it came back on Thursday. We picked it up, you know, in the formation blocks. And so I didn't know anything. And Esther was really instrumental in just getting me prepared for life, the very simple tasks of life, you know.
Pretty grounded lady. Yes.
Dad was good at that. Dad really pushed me to go and get a job as soon as I was old enough to get it. So one summer when I came out and stayed with them, the summer of my 15th year, I got a job in Brentwood, and I rode my bike to Brentwood, which is about, 30-minute bike ride, to work and back to the house every day in the summer. And I'll never forget. I don't know if I wrote this in the book. I don't know if it's in the book. I know I talked about it, but I don't know if it made it. The first time I got a check made out to me from a company, it was from Baskin Robbins. That was the first job I got, was scooping ice cream. I was so proud of myself. And it was nothing. It was like, I don't know, I think it was like $35. And I showed my dad and Esther the check, and they looked so proud. And that made me feel like I did something right, you know, like I was going to be okay. It's a big moment.
I can imagine. My producer screaming in my ear, saying to me, but Arlene Dahl, you didn't go into an Arlene. I want to know about Arlene. He's saying to me he had a crush on your mother when he was a kid growing up. Talk about your mother.
So many people did.
She was gorgeous, right?
Today, people come up to me and just tell me how much of a beauty my mother was. And she was and is still.
She's almost
incredible.
90, isn't she?
Yeah, she's in her 80s, and she hasn't lost a step. She goes out four nights a week with friends in New York City, and she's amazing.
She's amazing. You guys had kind of a rough time, though. It was a time when you didn't even talk to her, yes, growing up.
Yeah, that was tough. That was a tough time. That was about the same time that my father and Esther and I were very tight after high school. You know, when I came back out to the West Coast after having been back east at school for 4 years, I really turned my back on my mom, and I blamed her for all the challenges and all the difficulties I had as a kid, giving away dogs and moving around and getting used to new stepfathers, and I blamed her for not having a normal childhood, and it's not fair. It wasn't fair. And my first wife, Victoria, really helped me find peace with that and get a perspective that I didn't have at, you know, 18, 19, and was very instrumental in really mending the relationship with my mother.
Let's go back to the pudgy kid for a second. And I say this because you got the best of both of them. I said that. And you were a chick magnet. I mean, you go from being this pudgy kid to suddenly sprouting into this very good-looking teenager. Lucky you. You're being very serious with me now. But you tell a very funny story about the first time you saw your father's, what, manhood.
Oh, yeah. I was younger than that.
Talk to me.
He walked into the room that I was sleeping in. And he didn't think I was awake, and he walked in the bedroom. I mean, let's just say that something entered the room first.
God.
And I just thought to myself, I think I was like 8 or 9 years old. I just thought to myself, wow, so that's what it looks like when it's all grown up. I hope I have one of those.
How'd you do? Tell us.
Oh, that's not for me to say.
You're not going to tell us. Maybe one of those wives who we're going to talk about in a little while is going to tell us. So listen to me. You talked about this. I'm an animal person. Matter of fact, in our studio, always are my three little dogs sitting here. And you just told me that your dog is with you where you are now as we record this. But you had a lot of love for animals. That always tells me something about a person. And they came and they went. And your mother took your dog away. And my mother took my dog away, too. And I didn't talk to her for a year about it. You were going to be a veterinarian. That was a choice. That was one of the things you wanted to do.
I loved animals, and I just didn't think I would be happy doing anything else but taking care of them.
But then decided that wasn't what you wanted to do. What happened was
I was not accepted to the first two colleges of my choice because I just didn't have the academics, you know. Mm-hmm. And so that was the first sign that, you know, maybe medicine is not for me. You know, so I took a year off after high school. I graduated early. I graduated at 17. I took a year off and to really kind of figure out what I did want to do. And I talked it over with my father and with Esther. And I told them that I think I'd like to try acting and go to the college that I was accepted to, which was UCSB, University of California, Santa Barbara, and study theater, to which my father replied, "No effing way." And I said, "Why?" He goes, "I'm not sending you to a four-year university to graduate with a degree in theater. It's a waste of money. You'd spend 4 years in college, 4 years of your life in a dormitory, protected environment, and then have to come out to Los Angeles and knock on the doors that you could knock on now." So he said, "If you want to study acting, you want to be an actor, prove to me you can do it. I want you to go outside the house right now. I want you to think of a scene, something that you think you could get emotional about. Esther will be your scene partner, and you're going to come back into the room here, and you're going to improv the scene, because I want to make sure you're not going to make a fool out of me. So you go out there, you prove to me that you are not going to make a fool out of me, and show me that you can act, and then I might help you out." So there I was at 18, auditioning for my father, so that when I did get into an acting school or go to the casting sessions, I wouldn't embarrass him. I mean, that's crazy, right? That's pretty nuts. But it made perfect sense, and I did exactly that. I went outside, and I came up with a scenario that was emotional for me, and I did the scene with Esther, and Esther started crying. I started crying, and my father said, okay. Enough of you two.
And there it was. Right.
And I'd never set foot on stage. I'd never done any acting at all, ever.
In the jeans.
And my dad, I got his endorsement to then apply to go to an acting school here in L.A. in the Valley. It was a film actors workshop run by Tony Barr, who was a network executive at CBS. And it was an intensive acting school. You learned how to do everything. You learned how to act. You learned how to cold read. You learned how to work the camera. You learned how to work the lights. You learned about setting the scene, directing, using props, and all that stuff. And I got a job at Jack LaLanne's, which was a fitness club.
Right.
There was a chain of Jack LaLanne gyms all over the country, but there were quite a few of them here in the land of fruit and nuts. And so I did that. And so I worked during the day. As a trainer, and I parked cars on the nights that I didn't have acting school, and then the nights that I did have acting school, I learned craft, and I did that for about 2 years. And my acting coach, Laura Rose, I think I was 18 and a half, maybe 19, she said, I think you're ready to go out and start auditioning. No agent, no representation,
right.
Just I would cold call the casting agents on my breaks at the gym, and I would tell them who I was, and if they had anything in production or in the future, I would like to come in and read. And, you know, I'd make 50 calls a week, and I'd get, you know, a couple of callbacks, and I'd go in and I'd meet these folks. Eventually, it led to, you know, I'm not going to say regular work. I couldn't exactly quit my job at the gym or parking cars, but I did get some acting roles for a while.
Two things come to my mind. One is you grew up in this business, and so you knew how hard it was going in. And I guess what you just said, I can do it, and I'm not going to worry about how hard it's going to be. So you must have really wanted to do it. That was number one. A couple of things along the way that were pretty funny, but this may be out of sync with the timing, so forgive me for that. But I love the story about the fact that you went and somebody saw you and wanted to shoot you to be a playgirl centerfold.
That was about the same time.
About the same time.
I was working at At Jack Lane's, yeah.
So
there was a very famous
talk about that.
Modeling photographer, and he was at the gym. I'd see him all the time. He'd come in, work out, and leave. And then one day he said, "Hey, Lorenzo, come over here." And I said, "Yeah, what's up?" He goes, "Have you ever thought about modeling?" And I said, "Not around, really. What kind of modeling are you talking about?" He goes, "Well, I mean, I'm a photographer. I shoot a lot of male models, and they can make a lot of money." I go, "Doing what?" He goes, "Well, mainly nude." I go, "Yeah, I'm not sure about that." He goes, "Lorenzo, look," he says, "let's do a test shoot. You know, it's not going to, I mean, if they don't use the pictures, they won't go anywhere. But if they do use the pictures, you'll get $2,500 for the pictorial." And $2,500 at that time seemed like, you might as well have said $250,000, because I was struggling with three jobs, paying my car, my insurance, an apartment, and I was clearing about $75 cash a week from three jobs. So $2,500 and a chance to become famous, you know, in a Playgirl magazine and possibly win, you know, the contest for the year, and that's another $10,000. Why wouldn't I do it? So I called my mom, and my mom said, "Well, you've been working on your body for the last 2 years. You might as well do something with it."
My kind of girl.
And I didn't tell my dad, because I just knew. I knew my dad would just
freak,
go off. He would have a freaking heart attack. But I did ask the photographer if I could have my girlfriend in the pictures, because I don't want people reading the magazine to think that I'm gay, because I'm in a male nude magazine. And he said, "Yeah, that's fine. Bring your girlfriend and we'll shoot some pictures." So I did. Took the pictures, and long story short, they were going to go right to print, right in the magazine. They told the photographer that I was, like, between me and one other guy for the win for the year and the $10,000. And you have to read the book for the rest. But
the great part was, to me, the photos are long gone and nobody's ever seen them, and wouldn't we all love to have a look at that? But you got to read the book to find out what exactly happened at the end of that story.
Yeah, let's titillate them.
I know. I would love to see those now. So you meet Jimmy Komek along the way, who was absolutely one of the most brilliant men that ever walked the face of the earth in television, as far as I'm concerned. Well, Nat Cotter, Chico and the Man,
the courtship.
I knew him. A phenomenal guy. Just a phenomenal man. Oh, brilliant. And whatever he touched turned to gold, basically.
Yeah.
But he touched you.
He was the first professional, the first person in a position to make me a star, that believed in me, that saw me on I went into audition for a guest starring role on Welcome Back, Kotter. And I didn't get the part, but he remembered me. He remembered me, and obviously he liked something about me. So he used me in two pilots. I mean, not just the one pilot that didn't get picked up for series, but he came back to use the same actor that was in a pilot that didn't work. That's how much he believed in me.
Cool guy. He was a cool guy. Died too young.
The second pilot didn't work either, but I had so much respect. And after the second pilot didn't get picked up, and I was 20, I think, at the time, and heartbroken, just heartbroken. I wanted to be a sitcom actor like John Travolta and Henry Winkler, like you wouldn't believe. I love comedy. I love the three-camera shooting. I love shooting in front of a live audience. That's where I thought I was going to get my start on television, was on a sitcom. And then it didn't happen, and I was heartbroken. But Jimmy wrote a letter that I still have to this day. And in the letter it said, "Lorenzo," big capital letters, "you are a star. And one day we'll work together again, Jimmy." Uh-huh. And it gives me chills just thinking about it right now, because that little note from that guy gave me more confidence than anything that had ever happened to me up to that point.
He died too young.
And for many, many years after. You know, I when things didn't work out, when I got fired off the set of One Day at a Time, because I think Bonnie Franklin had an issue with me. The problem was I was a kid. I was heartbroken, and just remembering that note from Jimmy Komek gave me the ability to stick with it and to just continue to get turned down.
cool
over
guy.
And over and
yeah.
over again.
That's great. That's great. We go from there to Greece. Give us a quick, and I mean quick, because I want to get a lot of stuff in here, and I'm looking at that clock.
Greece was a pure accident. You know, my mom took me to the Academy Awards in 1977, and at the Governor's Ball, her publicist friend, Shirley Eder, introduced me to Alan Carr, who at the time was developing the movie with the music from Robert Stiglitz's label, RSO, and the Bee Gees. And I didn't know how, I mean, I just met Alan Carr. He seemed like a nice guy. You know, he's a big, you know, mainly a musical producer. Fine, great. And then, you know, 6 months later, I get a call to go meet Alan Carr on the Paramount lot. And it's to read for one of the T-Birds. Well, I get to the audition, and Alan brings me in the room, and he says, Lorenzo, we've cast all the T-Birds, but I think there's something that's very unique about you. This was before Jimmy Comeback.
Yeah, I can't, like I said, don't stay with
yeah,
me.
No,
on,
this yeah. is before Jimmy Comeback right. with Alan Carr. But, so Alan basically said, I'm going to keep something in mind, and, you know, don't be surprised if we give you a call. And another 6 weeks, I got a call saying that Stephen Ford had basically not worked out for one particular role.
See, let me say who Stephen Ford.
Jock.
Yeah, let me just say who Stephen Ford was.
Chisholm?
Yeah, Stephen Ford was the President Ford's son, stunning kid, who was going into Hollywood and then didn't.
Yeah, he had begun a career as an actor.
Right.
And they had cast him in the role. It didn't work out for one reason or another. And there was my break. You know, I was very lucky. Very lucky. It doesn't happen.
No.
So I got a chance to be in the biggest movie musical of all time.
You are listening to the Hallie Kasser Jane Show, always available online at HallieKasserJane.com. My guest today, author of Renegade at Heart, actor Lorenzo Lamas.
And there's a great story in the book, which we're not going to do it now, so you have to go read this fabulous little book of his. And what you're going to have to do is find out what happened with him and Olivia Newton. John, hilarious, absolutely hilarious. You are so cute, Lorenzo. You have such a way about you when it shows up in this book and your nerve, Renegade at Heart. Who came up with the name Lance Cumson for your character?
Well, that was Earl Hebner.
That name cracked me up,
Earl
sorry.
Earl Hebner yeah. was the writer, creator of The Waltons and then Falcon Crest. And I, you know, Earl was very, I mean, he's from West Virginia. He's very innocent. I don't think he knew what he was doing when he came up with that name, because that's hilarious, you know.
Everybody really?
Said, Lance Cumson, don't tell me you spell it C-U-M-S-O-N. I said, yes, it's exactly how they spell it. But, yeah, it was pretty funny.
That was great. And what a great
and
show
then
that was.
My mother on the show, Julia Cumson, was played by Abby Dalton, who later became my mother-in-law in real life.
You know, you are such a character. I mean, the way this all weaves, this story, I'm telling you, I was just beside myself reading this book. Before we get to that, I want to talk about Jane Wyman, because lucky you got to work with Miss Jane Wyman, former wife of President Ronald Reagan, one of the great actresses of her time, who I did not know till I read your book was not supposed to be that role. It was supposed to, they wanted Barbara Stanwyck for it, and she wouldn't take it. Nice bit of Hollywood trivia you put in there. What was it like to work with her? And she saved your butt a couple of times, by the way. Good lady.
Yeah. It was a little intimidating, even though I got along with her really well, because she was such a pro, you know, and I was such a greenhorn. You just really had to come to work prepared if you're going to do a scene with Jane, because everybody knew that she would know all her lines, you know, without a hitch. So it was a great kind of like a graduate school, I guess, for me.
Yeah. She was neat. You had some trouble on that set. One day you show up high as
well,
a kite on coke.
Well, I never did drugs right. Or drank at all on any set, you know, at all, unless I knew that I wasn't working for the day. And I'd gone home with some buddies from the set, and I thought I was wrapped. I didn't think I had any more scenes for the day, so we were partying down by my pool, you know, doing blow and smoking grass, doing stuff you did back in the 80s. And I got a call from the first assistant director that I had a scene after all, and it was with Jane. I go, what are you talking about? That scene's tomorrow. He said, no, Lorenzo, we moved it up. because we can't find the actor for the scene that we're supposed to shoot today. So you're needed on the set right away. Oh, my God. I was petrified. I was stoned out of my mind. It's a good thing that I didn't live very far from the studio, because I got in my car and raced down Laurel Canyon to get to the studio. I looked at my hand on the steering wheel, and I was gripping the steering wheel so hard, my hands were white. It was, and I walked into, I got in my dressing room, put my clothes on, walked into the makeup trailer, and I told my good friend Monet Manzano, who did my makeup, did everybody's makeup, but I just say he's my makeup artist because he did mine too, but I said, Monet, I said, I'm sweating like crazy. I'm having a nervous breakdown. How can you stop me from sweating? And he said, well, I'll put some anti-shine on your forehead. It was a new thing then. Now everybody uses it, but anti-shine kind of blocked your pores so you didn't sweat too much. So he just, I said, slap that anti-shine shit on me right away. And I got to the set. I did a couple of rehearsals with Jane for camera, and I just wasn't, I didn't know my lines. I didn't know the scene, and plus I was nervous, and I was making it worse, and so Jane called a break. She said, all right, everybody off the set, 15 minutes, and she looked at me when everybody was gone. She said, your father would be so ashamed of you right now. I go, oh, so sorry. She goes, you are high, aren't you? I go, yes. She goes, I never want you to come to work under the influence again. Do you understand me? I said, yes, ma'am. She said, now you go to your dressing room, you take 15 minutes, you learn the words, and you come back out here and we'll do the scene. I said, yes, ma'am. I went to my dressing room and I learned the scene, and I never, never did another line of coke on a workday for the rest of my career.
I wish I'd been there just to hear you and look at you and watch you say, yes, ma'am.
Now, you would have watched a person wilt in front of you.
Wilt. Well, she, as you say in the book.
You would have watched a person just melt into a puddle on the floor and then slither out of the stage under the stage door. That's what you would have seen.
So
it was just, it was the worst time, the worst experience in my life.
You mentioned many times in that part of the book, in that chapter, her withering glance. I mean, she must have been formidable. I can't even imagine. No, sir. Listen to me. You know, you are a character. You're being very serious with me today, and I wish you wouldn't be so serious, but you are a very serious guy, I guess.
Well,
but
you're asking serious
I'm
questions.
I'm asking you serious questions. Well, let's get into sex.
From a broken home.
All right. Well, let's get into
how
sex.
My life was.
Can we get into
in
sex?
But the book is humorous, and I wanted to make it humorous. I didn't want people to read a sob story.
No, it's emotional.
I tried to lace the book with some lighthearted humor, and you know, you got to look at life sometimes with a sense of humor, or else you get swallowed by it.
Absolutely, you know? Absolutely. So, listen to me. Let's talk sex. So, this is the reason I want to talk to you about sex, because never in my life have I read anything quite like you in sex. And these women, you've been married 5 times. You're on number.
Shauna is my fifth and wife. Yeah, you know, it took me 4 times to try to get it right.
You're a braver man than I, let me tell you.
Well, you know, I never lived with a person that I love and didn't marry.
Well,
my
I know that.
A joke about it. She goes, Lorenzo gives people like George Clooney a bad name because he falls in love and he marries them, you know, like she did, you know.
So I want to know this.
I was born 40 years too late.
Did you ever hear Kiss, Seal It With a Kiss? Why did you have to get married all of
these times? That is the $5 million question.
Yes. You still don't have the answer. Is it because you're a nice guy?
I have no idea. If I knew why, I kind of figured it out. I had to, or else I was just going to keep doing this, you know?
Yeah. So you're going to tell us so that the rest of us don't make the same mistake you did?
Therapy, I guess.
Therapy,
I just waited too long.
Therapy's it.
So, are there signs that you're a serial anything? Go get therapy.
It's a good point. I mean, there's no doubt about it. There's a good point. I'm going to let you off the hook for a minute, so take a breath, okay? You breathing? Because I know you probably didn't want to go down that road with me. We'll do it in spits and pieces. But let's talk cars. and the huge role, cars and machinery and speed. And what do you have, a friggin' death wish? I mean, listen to you.
I have a life wish. I feel alive, you know, when I'm handling a machine. I just feel more alive than I do when I'm not handling a machine. And if I don't ride a motorcycle or fly a helicopter, everything else in my life suffers. It really does. You can ask my wife. She goes, "You are acting miserable. You better go ride or fly or do something. Just leave the house."
So why do you think that is? What is that? Because you can gain control?
I really don't know what it is. It's not a death wish. I just feel I feel completely free when I'm on the controls of a motorcycle or a helicopter or an airplane or anything with a motor that goes. And it's not I think I'm going to race to my death. I like to control the machine. I raced cars because the challenge of it was very zen-like. You know, in order to go fast, you sometimes have to go slow. And it teaches you the skill of going around a racetrack, you know, and hitting the same parts of the track under braking and under acceleration and learning the track and learning the turns. Very, very consuming.
So
it's like you get addicted to it. You know?
So let me ask you this. I'm going to play Dr. Halley, okay? You don't mind, do you? So Dr. Halley says to Lorenzo, when you're in control of those machines, be it the plane that you're a pilot, in case people don't know, of regular planes and of helicopters you're flying these days, and you know you've been in a couple of bad accidents on big bikes and on the racetrack, I bet your mind goes a billion miles a minute. And maybe when you're concentrating on those things, the mind slows down and you're into a different zone, and that is what feels good and gives you relief.
I think that's exactly it. I think you hit it right on the head.
It's fascinating.
I think that the amount of concentration that it takes to do something with machines at a high rate of speed, it just, you can't think about anything else.
And acting is the same weapon, by the way, because you're in another space.
It is. You got to tune everything else out.
Right.
And just be with your scene partner. Yeah, you're absolutely right.
Right. So you have a hell of a mind going on there. Boy, I'd like to be in that head of yours for a couple of hours and see what it's like and what you're really thinking. I'm just kidding.
No, you don't.
Oh, yeah, I do. I would get a big kick out of that. So you watch your parents do this marriage thing, and then your mother in particular, 6, I think she's outdone you by 1, and you do the same thing. Lesson, you're slow to learn?
Am I what?
Slow to learn.
Yeah, obviously, I was, yeah. Slow to learn.
Are we shutting down on Helen now?
I just kind of didn't, I didn't think there was a problem. Because I think the marriages were a way of filling a hole that I was never satisfied, you know, with. You know, like the person that overeats, he's not eating because he's hungry. He's eating because he doesn't know how not to eat. I didn't know how not to be in a relationship.
Hard to be alone. Too much time spent alone as a child.
Too much time on your, you know, back when I couldn't be alone, I just hated being with myself.
Do you know what the saddest part in the whole book was for me? That left me, like, I couldn't even sleep. I thought about it. Maybe it must have related to something. And that was the thing when you were living at your dad's, in his garage, I guess, that they wouldn't let you in the house, that you had, there were strict rules that he, first of all, when he married, help me out, no kid from either marriage was allowed in the house.
Well, yeah, when he married Esther,
right.
Esther had 3 children
right.
that were living with their alcoholic father, and I don't even think Esther really wanted her kids living with her and dad, but even if she did, it would never have happened, because my father was a very proud Latin man that didn't want any other man's children under his roof. I mean, as archaic as that sounds, that's the truth. So if he didn't allow Esther's children to even so much as spend a night at their mother's house with my father, and they, very well, in his fairness, because he was very fair, he couldn't put his son under the roof because her kids weren't allowed. Do you get my drift?
Yeah.
So my roommate was a Rolls Royce, and that's the way it was.
But they wouldn't even let you in the house. I mean, even when that to me, that just, I don't know. That just broke my heart.
I know
heart
it's
for
weird.
You.
I know.
No. You know what
it's very
not...
strange. I couldn't. Yeah. I would. It doesn't even, it would not even enter my mind
right.
to do that to my children.
Right.
But my dad was a very different kind of guy. You know, I had different parents. I had very different parents.
You did have very different parents.
Yeah.
Speaking of those very different parents, your dad died very young of pancreatic cancer. That is just, oh my God, one day he was fine and the next he had a backache and the next couple of weeks later he was dead. Did you ever recover from that? Because I know that must have been really hard.
Well, eventually, but it took decades, really. It took years to get past the loss of a person that I thought I would never be able to handle the loss of. I was my biggest fear was losing my dad. He was my everything, you know? I mean, I waited with bated breath on every single thing he had to tell me. You know, he was, I didn't know how to do anything when I got out of high school. He showed me how to do everything. So my biggest fear was losing that guidance, losing that counselor, that very intelligent guy that was going to show me how to be a man in life. And then he was gone.
And
so I went crazy. I went nuts. I married people. I raced cars. I got in wrecks. I was just out of control. I had money because I was on a television series, and I was on a collision course with myself.
You are listening to the Hallie Kasser Jane Show, always available online at HallieKasserJane.com. My guest today, author of Renegade at Heart, actor Lorenzo Lamas.
Trainwreck. Had money? No money. How? What? Did you have to lose everything in order to learn?
I mean, some of it. Four wives and six kids. That'll do it. And no career.
Oh, God.
I mean, I was a particular kind of actor. I was an action star. I was a television action star. And in 2000, 2001, syndication, the shows like Hercules and Renegade and Xena, those shows were not being financed anymore by European companies like Canal Plus and Telemunchen. And those companies after the, it wasn't really a crash, but after 9/11, the European companies that were financing American television didn't do that anymore. They just wanted to finance their own television in their own countries because it was a lot cheaper. So now all of a sudden I'm unemployed. And I was a foreigner to the network casting people because I'd been in syndication for 5 years. So nobody knew me in Hollywood. I was in San Diego doing Renegade, and then when Renegade finished, that was it. It's like I wasn't working. And I had this huge overhead because of all the money that I did make on Renegade. And then one other show after that, or two other shows called, one was Air America. I did right after Renegade. And then after Air America, there was a show called The Immortal. That was the last TV action show I ever did. And that ended in 2000. And then it was nothing. So I had planes and boats and a Ferrari, and I lived behind gates up in Encino in a 6,000 square foot house with a $13,000 a month mortgage. And I just started bleeding financially, you know, because everything was financed. So I was bleeding, critically bleeding. And I just tried to just sell stuff. I had a fire sale of all my toys, and I just couldn't sell things fast enough. And I ended up being upside down. You know, that's how it happens. I mean, when you live, if I only listened to my father about one thing, it should have been about money.
Right.
Because he told me years ago, he said, Lorenzo, you don't have as much money as you made. You have as much money as you keep. So just because you make $2.5 million a year doesn't mean you're a millionaire if your monthly nut is $30,000 a month. Because you have to keep feeding that beast, you know, with financing charges and credit card debt and taxes. And it's just pretty nuts. That was a hard lesson.
Why are you so open? Why are you so willing to let it all out?
Because I just have nothing to be ashamed of. I really don't. I think that life is hard, and if you can share the good things with the people that might be curious about your life and the bad things, I don't know, maybe you might be able to help some people. Maybe see the hole in front of them without stepping in it, you know?
So, but here's the thing that I find fascinating. There were a lot of people who would like, oh, my God, I don't want anybody to know that I had a nervous breakdown or I lost my money or that I've been married 5 times, you know, and this one. A lot of people just can't get past their own right?
Yeah, no, I know. You have to. That's where therapy helped me a lot. is just to be okay with who I am.
So
Go
ahead.
I don't know. I had very low self-esteem. Thought I was a failure, you know. But my therapist really helped to see that I'm not the only one that has been through a financial crisis or that has, you know.
Emotional crap.
Been married, right. You know, 100 times and failed at it. You know, because everything that you fail at somehow makes you a stronger person if you survive it.
And, you know, you call the book Renegade at Heart. It's really interesting. I don't see you as a renegade. You're going to hate me for saying what I'm about to say, but I'm going to say it anyway, okay? Can I say it? Yes, I'm going to say it. I see you as just a nice guy.
Yes.
What's the dog's name?
No, no barking.
It's all right. What's the dog's name?
Oh, well, there's two.
Oh, there's two.
There's Ninja and Blueberry.
Kind, and they are what kind of dogs?
They're rescues. One's a Chihuahua Fox Terrier, and the other is a Chihuahua French Bulldog.
Ah, that's sweet. Okay, so...
How that happened, I'll never know.
So let me go back to where I was, which was I was saying the title of the book is Renegade at Heart. But I don't see you as a renegade, so shoot me, okay, for what I'm about to say. I think you're a nice guy. That's what I think. I think you got into all of this, and you get into all of this because at the heart of you, you really are a nice guy who just wants to have a nice life. Is that wrong? I mean, is that an image that would be hard for you to take?
No, it's not. I think you're right. I think the renegade in me is really the love of the open road, the freedom and sea and machines.
Yeah.
That's the renegade in me. And I think it was important to use that name in the title of the book too, because that's how people identify me. You know, I mean, to most folks out there that have seen my action movies and watch my TV shows, you know, I'm the renegade, you know? So I think that was initially what the publisher would serve the book's purpose, you know, to have some way of incorporating the title in that.
Yeah. I don't know. Nice guys finish first. You're remarried again. Another Shauna. We've had a couple of there, who is quite a bit younger
than one other one, right?
Yeah. Who is quite a bit younger than
this one? A chance because she had the same name as my ex-wife.
No. I'm not even going
That's
there.
Weird.
No, I mean, no.
When I told my friends,
they freaked out.
I was dating another Shauna. They got such a reaction. I said, "What? What am I supposed to do? Not date a person because she happens to have the same name as my wife?" And they're like, "Well, I don't know. It's just weird." I go, "Yeah, get over it."
Well, right. And she is your first wife was quite a bit older, and this one is quite a bit younger, right? How much younger?
My first wife, Victoria, was 13 years older.
Right.
And I am 30 years older than Shauna.
So, you know, each to their own. God bless. What's interesting to me about this relationship is that she's currently pregnant with your daughter's baby, or carrying as a surrogate. Right?
Yeah, I'm not talking about that.
All right. So it's out there. There we are.
I know. It's out there, and that's where it's going to be. We have an exclusivity deal with In Touch magazine. It's a wonderful story. It is not a circus act. It is about my wife, just in a nutshell. My daughter had a miscarriage a year ago, and she's not able to have children. But my daughter and my son-in-law did want another child, so they created life, and in vitro. And then my wife generously has volunteered to carry their child, my daughter's and my son-in-law's baby. So that's where it's at.
Yeah, so it's interesting, and it really is quite beautiful. You have custody of your three younger daughters that you guys are raising. So this is a whole new chapter for you, buddy. Talk to me.
Oh, yeah. I mean, every day is a new chapter. Or at least a new page in the chapter.
Yes. Are you enjoying it? Because you didn't raise the other kids all that much. So is this kind of interesting for you?
I'm in a very, very good place. I'm surrounded by people who I love and who love me. And I'm a commercial helicopter pilot that is spending his days now putting smiles on faces. And it sure beats the runaround that you get in Hollywood.
So are you done acting?
I don't think I'm done, but I'm not pursuing it. I don't have representation. I have relationships. And I've been offered to do a movie in Texas next month. from a production company that I worked with before, who I'm very, very fond of. They do quality work. Last year I did a movie called What Would Jesus Do? Part 2. Another great production company, and John Schneider is going to be, John Schneider stars in the movie as well. So I just do things with people that I love and respect, and I fly.
And you fly. The interesting thing to me here in all of this is to see this extraordinary growth in you. It's really quite delicious to, having read the whole book now and now talk to you. It's really quite something. God bless you. You know, your dad said something to you early on. He said, live, love, and make wise choices where your heart is concerned. The true measure of a man is how he handles the curves in his life. How'd you do, buddy? How do you think your dad thinks you did?
I don't know. I think Judgment Day is hopefully not too soon around the corner. We'll figure it all out. But I have a little saying that I've said, as being a parent and having six children and not being a perfect dad and then trying to be as close to, not perfection, but as close to being a good dad as I can. And my saying is that we are not judged by what we do in our life. We are judged by the actions of our children, or should be judged anyway, by the actions of our children, because that's where you leave your legacy. That's where people will determine what kind of a person you are, is what comes of your kids, how they grow and how they mature and what contributions they make to society.
I've been speaking with Lorenzo Lamas, loving father, husband, son, actor, singer, comedian, flyboy, and author of Renegade at Heart, available wherever books are sold. For more information on Lorenzo Lamas, visit him on Twitter, where his handle is Lorenzo Lamas. Before I go, I want to remind everyone that podcasts of current and past shows are always available to listen to free on iTunes under The Hallie Kasser-Jane Show. The Hallie Kasser-Jane Show is also available for download via Spreaker.com, Stitcher.com, BlogTalkRadio.com, and a host of other venues. Google The Hallie Kasser-Jane Show and you will find us. Of course, podcasts of our shows, both past and present, are always posted for your listening pleasure at HallieKasserJane.com. Which I hope you'll visit often for the latest information on our upcoming segments. Oh, and while you're at HallieKasserJane.com, don't forget to visit my blog to read my latest musings. I'll be back next week, same time, 3 p.m. Eastern, for another edition of The Hallie Kasser-Jane Show, Talk Radio for Fine Minds, brought to you by Audible.com. Get a free audiobook download at www.audibletrial.com/ The Hallie Kasser-Jane Show. Audible.com features over 100,000 titles to choose from for your iPhone, Android, Kindle, or MP3 player. Stay in touch, won't you? Remember, that's HallieKasserJane.com. Discover us on Facebook at HallieKasserJane and on Twitter at HallieCJ. I love to hear from you. So, till we meet again, this is Hallie Kasser-Jane. It's a wrap.